Chapter 17. Locke's Madmen, or Bell Curves in the Wrong Places. This is a simple illustration of the general point of this book in finance and economics. If you don't believe in applying the bell curve to social variables, and if, like many professionals, you're already convinced that modern financial theory is dangerous junk science, you can safely skip this chapter. I have in my house two studies, one real with interesting books and literary material, the other non-literary, where I don't enjoy working, where I relegate matters prosaic and narrowly focused. In the non-literary study is a wall full of books on statistics and the history of statistics, books I never had the fortitude to burn or throw away. Though I find them largely useless outside of their academic applications, Carneades, Cicero, and Fouché know a lot more about probability than all these pseudo-sophisticated volumes. I can't use them in class because I promise myself never to teach trash, even if dying of starvation. Why can't I use them? Not one of these books deals with extremistan. Not one. The few books that do are not by statisticians, but by statistical physicists. We're teaching people methods from mediocristan and turning them loose in extremistan. It's like developing a medicine for plants and applying it to humans. It's no wonder that we run the biggest risk of all. We handle matters that belong to extremistan, but treat it as if they belong to mediocristan, as an approximation. Several hundred thousand students in business schools and social science departments from Singapore to Urbana-Champaign, as well as people in the business world, continue to study scientific methods, all grounded in the Gaussian, all embedded in the ludic fallacy. This chapter examines disasters stemming from the application of phony mathematics to social science. The real topic might be the dangers to our society brought about by the Swedish Academy that awards the Nobel Prize. Only 50 years. Let's return to the story of my business life. In the last 50 years, the 10 most extreme days in the financial markets represent half the returns. 10 days in 50 years. Meanwhile, we're mired in chit-chat. Clearly, anyone who wants more than the high number of six sigma as proof that markets are from extremistan needs to have his head examined. Dozens of papers show the inadequacy of the Gaussian family of distributions and the scalable nature of markets. Recall that, over the years, I myself have run statistics backward and forward on 20 million pieces of data that made me despise anyone talking about markets in Gaussian terms. But people have a hard time making the leap to the consequences of this knowledge. The strangest thing is that people in business usually agree with me when they listen to me talk or hear me make my case. But when they go to the office the next day, they revert to the Gaussian terms so entrenched in their habits. Their minds are domain-dependent, so they can exercise critical thinking at a conference while not doing so in the office. Furthermore, the Gaussian tools give them numbers which seem to be better than nothing. The resulting measure of future uncertainty satisfies our ingrained desire to simplify, even if that means squeezing into one single number matters that are too rich to be described that way. The Clerk's Betrayal. I ended Chapter 1 with a stock market crash of 1987, which allowed me to aggressively pursue my black swan idea. Right after the crash, when I stated that those using sigmas, i.e. standard deviations, as a measure of the degree of risk and randomness, were charlatans, everyone agreed with me. If the world of finance were Gaussian, an episode such as the crash, more than 20 standard deviations, would take place every several billion lifetimes of the universe. According to the circumstances of 1987, people accepted that rare events take place and are the main source of uncertainty. They were just unwilling to give up on the Gaussian as a central measurement tool. Hey, we have nothing else. People want a number to anchor on, yet the two methods are logically incompatible. Unbeknownst to me, 1987 was not the first time the idea of the Gaussian was shown to be lunacy. Mandelbrot proposed the scalable to the economics establishment around 1960 and showed them how the Gaussian curve didn't fit prices then. But after they got over their excitement, they realized that they would have to relearn their trade. One of the influential economists of the day, the late Paul Kuttner, wrote, "Mandelbrot, like Prime Minister Churchill before him, promised us not utopia, but blood, sweat, toil, and tears. If he's right, almost all our statistical tools are obsolete or meaningless." I propose two corrections to Kuttner's statement. First, I would replace almost all with all. Second, I disagree with the blood and sweat business. I find Mandelbrot's randomness considerably easier to understand than the conventional statistics. If you come fresh to the business, don't rely on the old theoretical tools, and don't have a high expectation of certainty. Anyone can become president. And now, a brief history of the Nobel Prize in Economics, which was established by the Bank of Sweden in honor of Alfred Nobel, who may be, according to his family, who wants the prize abolished, now rolling in his grave with disgust. An activist family member calls the prize a public relations coup by economists aiming to put their field on a higher footing than it deserves. True, the prize has gone to some valuable thinkers, such as the empirical psychologist Daniel Kahneman and the thinking economist Friedrich Hayek. But the committee has gotten into the habit of handing out Nobel Prizes to those who bring rigor to the process with pseudoscience and phony mathematics. After the stock market crash, they rewarded two theoreticians, Harry Markowitz and William Sharpe, who built beautifully Platonic models on a Gaussian base, contributing to what is called modern portfolio theory. Simply, if you remove their Gaussian assumptions and treat prices as scalable, you're left with hot air. The Nobel Committee could have tested the Sharpe and Markowitz models. They work like quack remedies sold on the internet. But nobody in Stockholm seems to have thought of it. Nor did the committee come to us practitioners to ask our opinions. Instead, it relied on an academic vetting process that in some disciplines can be corrupt all the way to the marrow. After that award, I made a prediction. In a world in which these two get the Nobel, anything can happen. Anyone can become president. So the Bank of Sweden and the Nobel Academy are largely responsible for giving credence to the use of the Gaussian modern portfolio theory, as institutions have found it a great cover-your-behind approach. Software vendors have sold Nobel-crowned methods for millions of dollars. How could you go wrong using it? Oddly enough, everyone in the business world initially knew that the idea was a fraud. But people get used to such methods. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, supposedly blurted out, "I'd rather have the opinion of a trader than a mathematician." Meanwhile, the modern portfolio theory started spreading. I'll repeat the following until I'm hoarse. It's contagion that determines the fate of a theory in social science, not its validity. I only realized later that Gaussian-trained finance professors were taking over business schools and therefore MBA programs and producing close to 100,000 students a year in the United States alone, all brainwashed by a phony portfolio theory. No empirical observation could halt the epidemic. It seemed better to teach students a theory based on the Gaussian than to teach them no theory at all. It looked more scientific than giving them what Robert C. Merton, the son of the sociologist Robert K. Merton we discussed earlier, called The Anecdote. Merton wrote that before portfolio theory, finance was a collection of anecdotes, rules of thumb, and manipulation of accounting data. Portfolio theory allowed the subsequent evolution from this conceptual potpourri to a rigorous economic theory. For a sense of the degree of intellectual seriousness involved, and to compare neoclassical economics to a more honest science, consider this statement from the 19th century father of modern medicine, Claude Bernard. Facts for now, but with scientific aspirations for later. You should send economists to medical school. So the Gaussian pervaded our business and scientific cultures, and terms such as sigma, variance, standard deviation, correlation, R-square, and the eponymous Sharpe ratio, all directly linked to it, pervaded the lingo. Granted, the Gaussian has been tinkered with, using such methods as complementary jumps, stress testing, regime switching, or the elaborate methods known as GARCH. But while these methods represent a good effort, they fail to address the bell curve's fundamental flaws. Such methods are not scale invariant. This, in my opinion, can explain the failures of sophisticated methods in real life, as shown by the Makrodakis competition. If you read a mutual fund prospectus or a description of a hedge fund's exposure, odds are that it will supply you, among other information, with some quantitative summary claiming to measure risk. That measure will be based on one of the above buzzwords derived from the bell curve and its kin. Today, for instance, pension funds' investment policy and choice of funds are vetted by consultants who rely on portfolio theory. If there's a problem, they can claim that they relied on standard scientific method. More horror. Things got a lot worse in 1997. The Swedish Academy gave another round of Gaussian-based Nobel Prizes to Myron Scholes and Robert C. Merton, who'd improved on an old mathematical formula and made it compatible with the existing grand Gaussian general financial equilibrium theories, hence acceptable to the economics establishment. The formula was now usable. It had a list of long-forgotten precursors, among whom was the mathematician and gambler Ed Thorpe, who had authored the best-selling Beat the Dealer, about how to get ahead in blackjack. But somehow people believe that Scholes and Merton invented it, when in fact they just made it acceptable. The formula was my bread and butter. Traders, bottom-up people, know its wrinkles better than academics by dint of spending their nights worrying about their risks, except that few of them could express their ideas in technical terms, so I felt I was representing them. Scholes and Merton made the formula dependent on the Gaussian, but their precursors subjected it to no such restriction. More technically, remember my career as an option professional. Not only does an option on a very long shot benefit from black swans, but it benefits disproportionately from them, something Scholes and Merton's formula misses. The option payoff is so powerful that you don't have to be right on the odds. You can be wrong on the probability, but get a monstrously large payoff. I've called this the double bubble, the mispricing of the probability and that of the payoff. The post-crash years were entertaining for me, intellectually. I attended conferences in finance and mathematics of uncertainty. Not once did I find a speaker, Nobel or no Nobel, who understood what he was talking about when it came to probability, so I could freak them out with my questions. They did deep work in mathematics, but when you asked them where they got their probabilities, their explanations made it clear that they had fallen for the ludic fallacy. There was a strange cohabitation of technical skills and absence of understanding that you find in idiot savants. Not once did I get an intelligent answer, or one that wasn't ad hominem. Since I was questioning their entire business, it was understandable that I drew all manner of insults. Obsessive, commercial, philosophical, essayist, idle man of leisure, repetitive, practitioner, this is an insult in academia. Academic, this is an insult in business. Being on the receiving end of angry insults is not that bad. You can get used to it and focus on what's not said. Pit traders are trained to handle angry rants. If you work in the chaotic pits, someone in a particularly bad mood from losing money might start cursing at you until he injures his vocal cords, then forget about it and an hour later invite you to his Christmas party. So you become numb to insults, particularly if you teach yourself to imagine that the person uttering them is a variant of a noisy ape with little personal control. Just keep your composure, smile, focus on analyzing the speaker, not the message, and you'll win the argument. An ad hominem attack against an intellectual, not against an idea, is highly flattering. It indicates that the person doesn't have anything intelligent to say about your message. The psychologist Philip Tetlock, after listening to one of my talks, reported that he was struck by the presence of an acute state of cognitive dissonance in the audience. But how people resolve this cognitive tension, as it strikes at the core of everything they've been taught and at the methods they practice, and realize that they'll continue to practice, can vary a lot. It was symptomatic that almost all people who attacked my thinking attacked a deformed version of it, like, it's all random and unpredictable, rather than, it's largely random, or got mixed up by showing me how the bell curve works in some physical domains. Some even had to change my biography. At a panel in Lugano, Myron Scholes once got into a state of rage and went after a transformed version of my ideas. I could see pain in his face. Once in Paris, a prominent member of the mathematical establishment, who invested part of his life on some minute sub-sub property of the Gaussian, blew a fuse right when I showed empirical evidence of the role of black swans in markets. He turned red with anger, had difficulty breathing, and started hurling insults at me for having desecrated the institution, lacking pudeur, modesty. He shouted, "I am a member of the Academy of Science," to give more strength to his insults. The French translation of my book was out of stock the next day. My best episode was when Steve Ross, an economist perceived to be an intellectual far superior to Scholes and Merton, and deemed a formidable debater, gave a rebuttal to my ideas by signaling small errors or approximations in my presentation, such as Markowitz was not the first to, thus certifying that he had no answer to my main point. Others who had invested much of their lives in these ideas resorted to vandalism on the web. Economists often invoke a strange argument by Milton Friedman that states that models don't have to have realistic assumptions to be acceptable, giving them license to produce severely defective mathematical representations of reality. The problem, of course, is that these Gaussianizations don't have realistic assumptions and don't produce reliable results. They're neither realistic nor predictive. Also note a mental bias I encounter on the occasion. People mistake an event with a small probability, say, 1 in 20 years, for a periodically occurring one. They think that they're safe if they're only exposed to it for 10 years. I had trouble getting the message about the difference between mediocristan and extremistan through. Many arguments presented to me were about how society has done well with the bell curve. Just look at credit bureaus, etc. The only comment I found unacceptable was, "You're right. We need you to remind us of the weakness of these methods, but you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater," meaning that I needed to accept their reductive Gaussian distribution, while also accepting that large deviations could occur. They didn't realize the incompatibility of the two approaches. It was as if one could be half dead. Not one of these users of portfolio theory in 20 years of debates explained how they could accept the Gaussian framework as well as large deviations. Not one. Confirmation. Along the way, I saw enough of the confirmation error to make Karl Popper stand up with rage. People would find data in which there were no jumps or extreme events and show me a proof that one could use the Gaussian. This was exactly like my example of the proof that O.J. Simpson isn't a killer. The entire statistical business confused absence of proof with proof of absence. Furthermore, people didn't understand the elementary asymmetry involved. You need only one single observation to reject the Gaussian. But millions of observations won't fully confirm the validity of its application. Why? Because the Gaussian bell curve disallows large deviations. But tools of extremistan, the alternative, don't disallow long, quiet stretches. I didn't know that Mandelbrot's work mattered outside aesthetics and geometry. Unlike him, I wasn't ostracized. I got a lot of approval from practitioners and decision makers, though not from their research staffs. But suddenly I got the most unexpected vindication. It was just a black swan. Robert Merton Jr. and Myron Scholes were founding partners in the large speculative trading firm called Long Term Capital Management, or LTCM, which I mentioned earlier. It was a collection of people with top-notch resumes from the highest ranks of academia. They were considered geniuses. The ideas of portfolio theory inspired their risk management of possible outcomes, thanks to their sophisticated calculations. They managed to enlarge the Ludic fallacy to industrial proportions. Then, during the summer of 1998, a combination of large events, triggered by a Russian financial crisis, took place that lay outside their models. It was a black swan. LTCM went bust, and almost took down the entire financial system with it, as the exposures were massive. Since their models ruled out the possibility of large deviations, they allowed themselves to take a monstrous amount of risk. The ideas of Merton and Scholes, as well as those of modern portfolio theory, were starting to go bust. The magnitude of the losses was spectacular, too spectacular to allow us to ignore the intellectual comedy. Many friends and I thought that the portfolio theorists would suffer the fate of tobacco companies. They were endangering people's savings and would soon be brought to account for the consequences of their Gaussian-inspired methods. None of that happened. Instead, MBAs in business schools went on learning portfolio theory, and the option formula went on bearing the name Black Scholes Merton, instead of reverting to its true owners, Louis Bachelier, Ed Thorpe, and others. How to prove things. Merton the Younger is a representative of the school of neoclassical economics, which, as we've seen with LTCM, represents most powerfully the dangers of Platonified knowledge. I am selecting Merton because I found him very illustrative of academically stamped obscurantism. I discovered Merton's shortcomings from an angry and threatening 7-page letter he sent me that gave me the impression that he wasn't too familiar with how we trade options, his very subject matter. He seemed to be under the impression that traders rely on rigorous economic theory, as if birds had to study engineering in order to fly. Looking at Merton's methodology, I see the following pattern. He starts with rigidly Platonic assumptions, completely unrealistic, such as the Gaussian probabilities, along with many more equally disturbing ones. Then he generates theorems and proofs from these. The math is tight and elegant. The theorems are compatible with other theorems from modern portfolio theory, themselves compatible with still other theorems, building a grand theory of how people consume, save, face uncertainty, spend, and project the future. He assumes that we know the likelihood of events. The beastly word equilibrium is always present. But the whole edifice is like a game that is entirely closed, like Monopoly with all of its rules. A scholar who applies such methodology resembles Locke's definition of a madman, someone reasoning correctly from erroneous premises. Now, elegant mathematics has this property. It's perfectly right, not 99% so. This property appeals to mechanistic minds who don't want to deal with ambiguities. Unfortunately, you have to cheat somewhere to make the world fit perfect mathematics, and you have to fudge your assumptions somewhere. We've seen with the Hardy quote that professional pure mathematicians, however, are as honest as they come. So where matters get confusing is when someone like Merton tries to be mathematical and airtight rather than focus on fitness to reality. This is where you learn from the minds of military people and those who have responsibilities in security. They don't care about perfect, ludic reasoning. They want realistic ecological assumptions. In the end, they care about lives. I mentioned earlier how those who started the game of formal thinking by manufacturing phony premises in order to generate rigorous theories were Paul Samuelson, Merton's tutor, and in the United Kingdom, John Hicks. These two wrecked the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, which they tried to formalize. Keynes was interested in uncertainty and complained about the mind-closing certainties induced by models. Other participants in the formal thinking venture were Kenneth Arrow and Gerard de Brou. All four were Nobel'd. All four were in a delusional state under the effects of mathematics, what Dieudonné called the music of reason, and what I call Locke's madness. All of them can be safely accused of having invented an imaginary world, one that lent itself to their mathematics. The insightful scholar Martin Schubick, who held that the degree of excessive abstraction of these models a few steps beyond necessity makes them totally unusable, found himself ostracized, a common fate for dissenters. Medieval medicine was also based on equilibrium ideas when it was top-down and similar to theology. Luckily, its practitioners went out of business, as they couldn't compete with the bottom-up surgeons, ecologically driven former barbers who gained clinical experience, and after whom aplatonic clinical science was born. If I'm alive today, it's because scholastic top-down medicine went out of business a few centuries ago. If you question what these formal thinkers do, as I did with Merton Jr., they will ask for tight proof. So they set the rules of the game, and you need to play by them. Coming from a practitioner background in which the principal asset is being able to work with messy but empirically acceptable mathematics, I can't accept a pretense of science. I much prefer a sophisticated craft focused on tricks to a failed science looking for certainties. Or could these neoclassical model builders be doing something worse? Could it be they're involved in what Bishop Huet calls the manufacturing of certainties? Let's see. Skeptical empiricism advocates the opposite method. I care about the premises more than the theories, and I want to minimize reliance on theories, stay light on my feet, and reduce my surprises. I want to be broadly right rather than precisely wrong. Elegance in the theories is often indicative of Platonicity and weakness. It invites you to seek elegance for elegance's sake. A theory is like medicine or government. often useless, sometimes necessary, always self-serving, and on occasion, lethal. So it needs to be used with care, moderation, and close adult supervision. I've presented my ideas in finance because that's where I refined them. Let us now examine a category of people expected to be more thoughtful, the philosophers.